You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Wisconsin's first election of 2022 is just around the corner. The last day of voting for the Milwaukee mayoral primary is February 15th. It's one of the nonpartisan primaries going on around the state. Early voting in the primary, which includes seven candidates all hoping to replace former Mayor Tom Barrett, is already underway. The top two candidates would advance to the April 5th special election. At WPR.org/Central Time, we've linked to the WPR landing page for all of our coverage of the mayor's race. That includes conversations Kate Archer-Kent is having with the candidates on The Morning Show. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Wherever you are, what are your questions about the run for mayor in Milwaukee? Your thoughts on it? If you're in Milwaukee yourself, what do you want from a new mayor? What issue do you want to see them focusing on? What do you want to hear them talking about? What should be their priority for day one on the job? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Larry Sadler is a journalist who's covered Milwaukee for the better part of four decades, including 30 years at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He's written on a range of topics, including city and county government, politics, and transportation. His latest piece for Milwaukee Magazine is called What to Watch For in the Milwaukee Mayoral Primary. Larry, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, this is a rare thing in Milwaukee, historically speaking. It's pretty rare that there's not an incumbent mayor in races there. How uncommon is this?
This is only the fourth time in 62 years, Rob, that we have had an election for mayor without an incumbent on the ballot. Milwaukee tends to reelect incumbents very frequently. And so, as a result, we have had only seven mayors, elected mayors of Milwaukee in the last century.
Wow. And there was some question about when this election was going to happen. It is, in fact, in this this primary season now. But depending on former Mayor Barrett's confirmation as U.S. Ambassador to Luxembourg, this could have been, what, as late as this fall?
It easily could have been. And some people thought that there might even have been some maneuvering on the part of Senate Democrats to do that, so that it would increase turnout in the fall election in Milwaukee, which is a very blue city, and therefore perhaps influence the Senate election of U.S. Senate election of Ron Johnson. That did not happen. And coincidentally, it was not too long after I wrote about that, that the Senate did in fact confirm Barrett right in time to get on the ballot for this spring election, which ordinarily would have been just county board and judicial races.
And you mentioned turnout. Does a Milwaukee mayor race tend to bring a lot of people out, so in the primary and then in the general?
Well, we have not had this exact situation of an election for mayor with no incumbent on the ballot and no other major race on the ballot since the 1940s. So it is very hard to predict exactly what the turnout is going to be.
Fair enough.
in the previous two elections, let me back up a bit. In 1960 and 1988, there were open races for mayor, but there were also races for county exec. In those races, it was around 21-23%. In 2004, when Mayor Barrett was elected, it was a 10-way primary, but it was the same day as the presidential primary. Turnout was up then about 40%. This time, really hard to say. It could be in the 20s. It could be as high as 30%. That's the unofficial prediction from the City Election Commission executive director.
And you've been looking at another piece of math, the number seven, which is how many candidates are going to be on the ballot. It's going to get narrowed down to two. But seven means, depending on how it gets sliced up, somebody could end up on the final ballot without actually winning a whole ton of votes.
Absolutely true. And now, historically, that has not happened. In most prior elections, the second place finisher has had at least 30%. But, you know, with seven candidates on the ballot, you could have a lot fewer. You could have as few as, you know, 15%. And possibly be the second place finisher.
We are talking about the race for mayor in Milwaukee, a rare race for mayor in Milwaukee without an incumbent on the ballot. We are talking to Larry Sadler, longtime journalist in Milwaukee. He's got a piece in Milwaukee Magazine previewing the mayoral primary. You can meet the candidates with interviews on the morning show, listen live, and find them archived online over at WPR.org. And now you can join in with your thoughts on this race, your questions about it, 800-642-1234, wherever you are. What are you watching for when you look at Milwaukee and its next mayor? If you live in Milwaukee itself, love to hear from you. What is on your mind as you approach this election? 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. Let's, Larry, take a whirlwind tour of our seven candidates here. If you can give us a little capsule of each of them, starting with, and we don't have a mayor. We've got an acting mayor, the head of the city council, a Cavalier Johnson.
Yeah, so he is one of the youngest people on the ballot, maybe the youngest in this particular race, and I believe one of the youngest ever to be mayor. He is just 35 years old. He has been on the council for 6 years, two of them as council president. Prior to that, he was an aide to Mayor Barrett, working on community relations and workforce development. The next we would have, State Senator Taylor, mm-hmm. Lena Taylor. She has been, in office now since 2004 in the Senate after 1 year in the Assembly. She is a well-known figure in Milwaukee politics. In addition to her time in the legislature, she ran for county executive in 2008, and also ran for mayor in 2020. Obviously didn't win either of those times. And she would be the first Black woman to be mayor, just as she is the second Black woman to be a state senator. Cavalier Johnson would be the first Black man to be mayor in his own right, as opposed to acting mayor. Then we have Sheriff Ernell Lucas. He is a career law enforcement officer. He was a member of the Milwaukee Police Department for, I believe, 25 years, starting as a patrol officer, rising to the rank of captain. He did survive a shooting on duty, came back from that, as I said, rose to captain, and he then left the police department and became a security official for Major League Baseball. Came back from that job to run for sheriff in 2018. And so he is finishing up his first term as sheriff. No indication whether he would plan to run for re-election if he loses this race. Let's see. Then we have Alderwoman Marina Dmitrievich. She has been on the council for only 2 years, but before that, she was on the county board for 16 years. The youngest person ever elected to the county board. I believe she was just 22 or 23 at the time. She also served as county board chair and was the second woman and the youngest person to serve as county board chair. And then among the top five, we also have, last but not least, Alderman Bob Donovan, former Alderman mm-hmm. Bob Donovan, who was on the council for 20 years, ending in 2020. He ran for mayor in 2016, lost to Tom Barrett, as Senator Taylor did. And he is, certainly the most conservative in the race, having had a strong law and order stand and also dedicated opposition to the Milwaukee streetcar, the HOP.
And then there are two, I think it's fair to say, lesser known candidates or lower profile candidates, a businessman Michael Sampson and community activist Aisha Griffin.
That is correct. Sampson is an events planner. He has an events planning company. Aisha Griffin was actually better known a few years ago. She ran for, I think, 5 or 6 offices, including mayor and county exec, first came to prominence as a state assembly candidate. She was running as an independent and tried to get on the ballot with a slogan that I don't think I can say on public radio. She lost both the battle to get the slogan on the ballot, and she lost all of her races. She's never gotten more than 1,500 or so votes for anything.
We're talking a longtime Milwaukee journalist Larry Sandler, looking at the candidates and some of the biggest issues in the Milwaukee mayoral primary. Now underway, early voting, last day of voting on February 15th, the primary election day itself. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What issues do you want to hear candidates from Milwaukee mayor focusing on? Whether you're looking in from the outside or you live or have lived recently in Milwaukee, what are the most important issues? What do you think the city needs from a new mayor? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our talk with Larry Sandler, journalist who's covered Milwaukee city and county government, politics, and transportation for over 30 years, 30 of those years with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We're talking about the race for mayor there. The primary's coming up, 7 candidates on the ballot to replace former mayor Tom Barrett, who resigned to take an ambassador position in Luxembourg. You can join in with your thoughts on the candidates, the issues, or with your questions about the race at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Let's bring on a caller now. Chris is with us in Madison. Chris, hi.
Hi. I worked for 15 plus years within the government structure of Milwaukee. I grew up actually in central Wisconsin and moved to Milwaukee and had sort of a culture shock and realized that how the attitudes of the rest of the state and it affected how the government funding toward the city is so lacking.
Chris, thanks for the call. Larry, that's been a concern raised recently, and I think in the past, concerns about state government shared revenue going to Milwaukee, support, a feeling of us against them with Milwaukee sometimes. Do you see that as something people are talking about there?
Yeah, and it comes out not so much in the way that the caller said, but it comes out in the results that the city doesn't have the kind of resources that it wants to deal with all of its problems. And so particularly now that the city is facing some serious pension funding issues that are going to be affecting its budget in the next few years, that's going to be more and more of an issue. They got a brief reprieve from that thanks to the federal aid that all local governments received. But, you know, that's not going to last forever. And they will have to deal with it. There have been a number of debates about how to deal with it. You know, certainly for many years, the city officials and county officials had pushed to get more shared revenue. They didn't get anywhere on that, and the share of shared revenue remains stagnant. They have been pushing more recently to get more revenue options in terms of perhaps a local sales tax. That also has not gone anywhere in the Republican-controlled legislature, even though Governor Evers was supportive of it.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We'll go next to Todd in Milwaukee. Todd, hi.
Hi there.
What did you want to ask about,
just
Todd?
A question. Just wanted to ask if any campaign, a write-in campaign, has ever been effective in the Milwaukee mayor race?
Oh, Todd, interesting question. Larry, write-in campaigns tend to be real long shots. Have you encountered any prominent ones in the race for Milwaukee mayor?
No, No, and in fact, even candidates who are on the ballot, you know, if they're not well-known politicians with, you know, sizable campaign treasuries, they tend not to do very well. And so, you know, for a mayor's race, you're not going to succeed as a write-in. Certainly at a district level race, I have seen people win write-in campaigns. You know, that's a whole different story.
Todd, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Larry Sandler, journalist in the Milwaukee area. He wrote recently about Milwaukee's mayoral primary in Milwaukee Magazine. Still time for your calls at 800-642-1234. Wanted to get into a couple issues. The funding there is one of them, Larry. I know Milwaukee is one of many communities around the country that have seen a rise in violence, gun homicides in particular, in the last couple of years. What kind of things are candidates saying about gun violence and public safety?
Well, there's a real range of approaches that the candidates are taking here. Bob Donovan has made his career as a law and order conservative and frequently with support from the police union, although I don't believe they've endorsed yet in this campaign. He wants to see more police officers on the street, and he takes generally a fairly enforcement-oriented approach, although he does talk about the need for community policing. By contrast, some of the other candidates are taking more of an approach of alternative measures and talking about the need to have more mental health professionals, for example, dealing with people rather than necessarily sending police to every call. Cavalier Johnson has introduced a plan that really covers both approaches. And so he's more diverse in his approach. I think, but he's not talking about increasing the police department. He's talking about maintaining the strength that they have. And some of the other candidates do talk about maintaining the strength of the police department, but also talk about getting at kind of the root causes of crime and addressing social issues.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Steve is with us in Oak Creek. Steve, hi.
How you doing?
Good. What'd you want to bring up, Steve?
Milwaukee County Parks. We're having a problem at Bender Park with getting that dredged. Milwaukee County Parks is claiming they have no money to do that. How does the state get involved with giving them more money in order to take care of the Milwaukee County Parks, not just including Bender, but all the Milwaukee County Parks?
Steve, thanks for the call. Now, it gets tricky, and I think people may blur these. That's the Milwaukee County system. This is the city of Milwaukee. Mayor's race, Larry, I don't know if you have thoughts on Steve's question, but I think sometimes those services may, the boundaries must get blurred in Milwaukee City and Milwaukee County.
Right. And as you say, that is not something that the city of Milwaukee candidates would get involved in. That is strictly a county issue. And in fact, the park that he referred to is in the suburb of Oak Creek. So it's not even within the city limits. It does get to the question that the earlier caller was talking about with shared revenue or alternate ways of raising revenue, because certainly the county does have a backlog of maintenance, deferred maintenance, and capital needs in its parks and other facilities.
Thanks for the call, Steve. Another issue I know you have your eye on, Larry, is economic development for the city's future. What kind of things are candidates talking about there?
So there also are a range of proposals. One thing that comes up in every mayoral campaign is people talking about the need to have development in the neighborhoods versus downtown. And everybody says this. It seems to be harder to do than to talk about. You know, certainly Mayor Norquist and Mayor Barrett and, you know, talked about it, and they had some successes, but there's always a feeling that the downtown gets more than the neighborhoods. So again, you have candidates here. All of the candidates are saying they support neighborhood development as well as downtown development. There are some interesting ideas. Senator Taylor is talking about urban agriculture as an industry that should be nurtured to spur development. in downtown, throughout Milwaukee. Bob Donovan is talking about manufacturing tiny houses as something that could not only be a way of attracting development and jobs, but also dealing with the problem of homelessness. Alderman Dmitrievich talks about childcare as a way of supporting the workforce and approaching the economic issues that way. So there's a whole range of ideas about how to deal with it.
I won't ask you to predict outcomes here, Larry, of course, but what kind of things are you watching for that you think may swing this primary toward one, well, I guess toward two candidates or somebody else?
Well, two things to look for, obviously, are how they're doing in the polls and how they're doing in terms of finances. And there, Cavalier Johnson is in the lead in both cases. The one independent poll had him at 25%. He has more than $350,000 in the bank, which is more than anybody else. And he has the support of former county executive Abley, who is capable of spending a great deal of money in both independently, and he's already given the maximum contribution to Johnson. Sheriff Lucas and Alderman Dmitrievich have healthy campaign treasuries of more than $100,000. Donovan is in the $60,000 range. Senator Taylor got into the race late and did not have to file a campaign finance statement.
And that's all the time we have. Sorry, Larry Sadler is a journalist in Milwaukee. He joined us for a look at the mayoral primary in Wisconsin's biggest city. Coming up after the news, we'll learn about the history of hobbies and how they function in our daily lives and in our society. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, it's Freezer Friday. That's Food Friday, talking about freezer meals, recipes that are just as good, if not better, once you've made, frozen, and then reheated them. First, the pandemic left many of us with more time to explore our hobbies or try new ones. Hobbies can be a good way to pass the time and discover our passions. Sometimes, though, they can feel less like leisure and more like work. Some are more relaxing than others, but just because a hobby is productive doesn't mean it's better or worse than any others. Our next guest has written about the history of hobbies, what they say about ourselves and our economy. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What are your hobbies? Do you find them relaxing? Are they productive? A little bit of both? How important are they in your life? Have you ever tried to turn a hobby into a source of income? Have you ever felt guilty for not doing enough of your hobby? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Stephen Gelber is a historian and professor emeritus at Santa Clara University. He's author of the book Hobbies, Leisure, and the Culture of Work in America. Stephen, thanks a lot for joining us today.
No, thank you. Excuse me. Thank you very much for having me.
Sure.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Historically, when did we first see what we now think of as hobbies really come into their own as part of our mass culture?
As part of the mass culture, in the Victorian period, hobbies become a way for people who are increasingly having leisure time to fill it. Women have more than men, because men are now leaving the home to go to work, and men eventually join as they get more time off after work and on weekends. We're talking here primarily about middle-class people.
You've written specifically about a hobby boom during the Great Depression here in the United States. Can you talk about why hobbies got big in this tough time?
Yes. My basic position on hobbies, or at least on many hobbies, not on all, is that they replicate work. In other words, what people do in their hobbies requires some of the same skills and many of the same values that they use when they're on the job. If they don't have a job, then they look for something to do in their leisure time that will replicate what they normally would have done, or at least give them the sense of satisfaction that they normally would have gotten from work.
And I want to talk about that idea you just introduced there, the idea that a hobby at home that we might think of as it's this thing that I do when I'm not working. You say that over time it almost was like taking our work attitude, our work regimentation in some ways, and figuring out a way to use it at home. Can you talk about that a little more?
Sure. Until the Industrial Revolution, people's leisure time was more or less interspersed with their work time. If you worked from handicrafts at home, or if you were a farmer, or if you ran a small shop, you could always stop working. I mean, you could stop working and go to lunch. You could stop working and go fishing. Sometimes you had to stop working because it was Wisconsin and there was too much snow. You had to milk the cows, but otherwise it may not be that much to do. In other words, leisure time was part of the daily cycle of things. But once people began to work away from home, in factories, in offices, their leisure time became a time when they could not work even if they wanted to. And so they looked for things to do, and traditionally or historically, leisure time was always seen as a dangerous time because you could drink, you could gamble, you could do things that were not approved of by the traditional Protestant work ethic society, and that was particularly true in the United States.
And there are other kinds of leisure time that I think we tend to look down on, even if they're not a vice, like you mentioned, the drinking and gambling, just sheer slacking, doing nothing. Maybe now we might include watching TV or something like that in that category. How have we built these barriers between, I guess, okay uses of our leisure time, a hobby, versus just slacking?
Hobbies came to be seen by powers that be, by which we mean mostly educators, but not exclusively, parents, a form of educators, as a way to use leisure time usefully or productively, as you said in your introduction. If you're doing something useful or productive, then you're not doing something that's a vice or destructive. And so hobbies, particularly in the 30s, came to be promoted as a way to prevent people who were not working, either voluntarily or involuntarily, from becoming, dangerous. People who are drinking, people who are engaging in public vices, people who are just lying about are, from a social cultural point of view, they're dangerous people. They're not productive people. And so hobbies fill that void. They require you, or at least the hobbies I talk about in my book, require you to do many of the same things that you would do at work. Not literally, obviously, they're leisure, but you need to think about them. You need to plan for them. You do them and you get some sort of a product. It's a product that you can show off. This is the same mental process. This is the same, if you will, psychological or sociological process that you go through in your work. And so then your work and your leisure time reinforce each other rather than create a kind of cognitive dissonance or a kind of conflict between what you do at work and what you do in leisure.
Do you think that's bad, that we have this work mentality into our hobby, our leisure life?
Not at all. No. I'm not passing any kind of a value judgment here. I got interested in this aspect of hobbies because I started thinking about, well, why do I do the things that I do and how do they work? And I think all human beings, probably in almost all societies, try to make their lives congruent. That is to say, they don't want to do things that in one sphere of their life that conflict in some fundamental way with the things they do in another sphere of their life. And so they, either consciously, but probably mostly subconsciously, look to create a kind of, as they say, a kind of congruence or a kind of continuity between work and leisure.
Talking to Stephen Galber, historian and professor emeritus at Santa Clara University, author of the book Hobbies, Leisure, and the Culture of Work in America. You can join in to tell us about your hobby, what led you to pick it up, what it means to you, why you like doing it more than something else or nothing else in your off time. Call 800-642-1234. If you picked up a new hobby or rediscovered an old one during the pandemic, let us know. 800-642-1234. Stephen, your book came out before this current pandemic, but I think hobbies have changed for people. We've had more time, maybe more desire to do these things. And for a lot of people, the line between home and work disappeared because a lot of them were working at home. What are your thoughts on what that might have meant for hobbies?
I have given that a fair amount of thought, not as a scholar since I am retired, but I think what's happening is that people are looking for ways to remain productive in their own eyes. In other words, what you're doing when you take up whatever it is you're taking up in most of them seem to be craft hobbies, baking bread or doing scrapbooks or whatever it is that you are saying, look, I'm working sometimes and I'm doing hobbies sometimes, but I am doing them in a way, I'm doing each of those in a way that reinforces the other and makes me feel maybe less guilty about being home and not going into the office. But of course, that's sheer conjecture on my part. I don't have any hard data to back that up.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Rebecca is with us in Newton. Rebecca, hi.
Hi, I just wanted to share my new hobby that I've discovered since the pandemic started. And I'm sure it's a hobby a lot of people do, but I never realized how fulfilling it could be. And that's paint by number. I paint by number every day. I can't wait till I get home. I think about my painting when I'm at work. I can't wait to finish it. I take a picture after each color and then I post it on the internet and show everybody how it came together. And then I store them in a box and never put them anywhere. It's just the doing them that's fun, and I never hang them up or do much with them, but I just love it.
It's fun, and Rebecca, I wonder, it sounds like the kind of thing, like I started doing jigsaw puzzles really for the first time ever, and it's like your brain is focused on this thing, and I don't know, it blocks out the other stuff. Is that just me, or do you feel that too?
Very much so, and it took my mind off of the stress of the pandemic and the worry. It helped me focus. It gives me a lot of focus. And it's just, I don't know, my job is very stressful. I work in healthcare. Ooh. I treat COVID patients. So when I come home, I want something that takes my mind off that and just keeps me busy so I don't have time to think or worry. And I just love it. And I don't know. I'm going to keep doing it.
I love it. Thanks for sharing that story, Rebecca. Thanks for the work you're doing. I'm glad you found a great way to do something in your off time. What do you think, Stephen?
The kinds of hobbies that you were speaking of and that the caller spoke of are, I think, a different category from what I'm talking about. I would call those sort of meditative. In other words, if you're doing something where the process is predefined and you're just sort of engaging in it, which is certainly a jigsaw puzzle, unless, of course, you're designing and building your own jigsaw puzzle.
I am not.
But the caller said something very interesting, which is, I think, a crucial component of a hobby, and that is she said while she was at work, she was thinking about it. Mm. And the thing that one of the components of a hobby that make them hobbies is they take up a lot of mental space. I joke in my book, but it's partially a joke, is hobbies are like sex. You think you spend much more time thinking about it than you do doing it. But it occupies your mind, and it in that sense, it becomes more important than the actual doing of the hobby.
Interesting. Thanks again for that call. We're talking to historian Stephen Gelber about hobbies and why we do them. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Tell us about your hobbies, what they mean in your life, if you've picked up new ones, if you've changed your approach to hobbies, maybe during the pandemic. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. The conversation continues coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up the conversation with historian Stephen Gelber. He's with us today talking about hobbies and how we strike a balance between leisure and productivity. And you could join in with your hobby at 800-642-1234. Tell us what you're into, what you've gotten into lately, what it means in your life, in your leisure time. 800-642-1234 is the number. We'll go back to your calls now. John is with us in Minocqua. Hi, John.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What's your hobby, John?
Well, my hobby throughout my entire life has been home remodeling, and I've worked in the corporate world my entire life and decided to take my hobby and make it my work. So I have partially retired and now have a handyman business. So I've gotten out of the corporate world and just decided to start my own business and turn my hobby into my work.
Well, John, a question I have for anybody, I think, who takes a hobby and turns it into a job. Is it less fun when it's, you know you're dependent on the money where you're getting paid for it and having to meet somebody else's needs?
So far it has not been.
Good.
I just enjoy doing it. It's a lot of fun. I enjoy helping people out. Kind of our focus of our business is helping seniors stay in their homes a little bit longer through basic remodeling to keep them safe. So it's rewarding in itself.
Oh, I love it. It's very purposeful. John, thanks for sharing that. Stephen, the idea I think has come up for a lot of people of, can my hobby be something I make money at? John's found a happy answer to that, I think. I don't know if everybody does.
That is one of the chronic questions among hobbyists. Can I turn my hobby into a job? And of course, people like the caller have done that, and they're very happy doing that. But usually the answer has been, no, they can't, because what makes a hobby leisure rather than work is that you are the complete a boss. You don't depend on it. You work when you do. That is to say, you work at your hobby when you do and when you want to, and you don't when you don't want to. If you turn it into your job, then you have to meet your costs. You have to make a profit. You have to do a kind of accounting, and it ceases to be the same thing. You still may enjoy it, of course. Mm-hmm. But your caller, of course, noted he was in semi-retirement, so he's only semi-working at a semi-hobby. So he created a balance by doing half of each.
Thank you so much for sharing that story. Keep up the good work at 800-642-1234. Eric joins us next in Green Bay. Eric, hello.
Hi.
Oh, what did you want to tell us about, Eric?
I crochet, have been for like 25 years.
Cool.
And
what do you like about it?
But I get it's like Zen. It's repetitive. And so I kind of, it's relaxing. And I can do it while I'm like watching TV or listening to NPR, because I don't have to focus on it if I don't have to watch what I'm doing, like driving, for instance. I can crochet. So it's relaxing for me.
And Eric, can I ask, what do you do with the final products?
So I tend to give them away. I do a lot of dishcloths and washcloths because they're easy to do while I'm just sitting around. But I have a couple bins underneath my bed just full of dishcloths and washcloths, but blankets and scarves and Socks. I've done socks.
Excellent. Eric, I strongly approve of any hobby you can do while you listen to public radio. Steven, your thoughts? It's a Zen thing. There is a final product. He shares it with people around him.
Yes. What the one element of that, of course, is what, like jigsaw puzzles we spoke about earlier, is it's routine and you can pay attention to it, but you don't have to totally focus on it. You can be focused on something yourself. But there is a product, and the product has value. You can sell it at a Christmas craft fair, or you can give it to people for their birthday, or you can use it in your house, and people will come and say, oh, that's wonderful. You should make those and sell them. You know, and there's a kind of satisfaction that comes from that, where people confirm that you are doing something productive. Historically, if I may add just a note here,
sure.
That is one of the major differences between the kinds of hobbies that men and women did. Men tend to do things that have a more obvious market value, whereas women tended to do things that had more of an aesthetic value, that they were considered beautiful, or they were, you know, not merely that they were feminine objects. Obviously, crochet was more traditionally a female hobby, but the fact that the man who called in was, you know, he made these products and then he was giving them away. That kind of crosses the gender line a little bit, but it's a complicated one. And of course, as women have become more and more engaged in the work for hire sphere, then that whole distinction has blurred. And I assume that there is a real blurring in hobby divisions, but I'm actually, you have to speak to a sociologist about that.
Thanks a lot for sharing that with us. Time for at least one more caller. Russ is on the line in Belleville. Russ, hello.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. Well, I got into making birdhouses, but I use unique material. I use rigid styrofoam that typically is used in the building trade.
Okay, and you make birdhouses. Now, I assume you can only have so many birdhouses in your yard. Is this something you share with other people, maybe in your neighborhood?
Well, I share online with these birdhouses are for purple martins, which is a species that's totally dependent on humans. So I share it with a website of other purple martin landlords or wannabe landlords. So I'm just spreading the knowledge, and I came up with this technique where I make single units now that I use a lamination technique. I don't think anyone's ever done it before, and it just cool to invent something and make it and then see how it ends up.
I love it, Russ. Good luck luring purple martins to your latest houses. Thanks for sharing that story with us. Steven, there's a pride there in his invention he mentioned.
Absolutely, and a creativity. He thinks he has come up with a new technique for making birdhouses. And this is precisely the sort of thing that I was talking about. He, in his leisure time, he does a hobby with a product, and it's not merely a product, it's a product that he thought of, and he thinks of new ways of doing it, and it's a form of creativity, absolutely.
Thanks for that call, Russ. In our last few moments, Stephen, if I may ask a personal question, do you have a favorite hobby?
I do. I design and build things out of wood, furniture, boxes, artworks. I've been a woodworker for most of my life. I started off because I needed to make things for the house I couldn't afford and continued because I just enjoy doing woodwork.
I love it. We'll leave it there. Stephen, thanks so much for joining us today. It's been a lot of fun.
Oh, you're quite welcome. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it. Bye-bye.
That's Stephen Gelber, historian and professor emeritus at Santa Clara University. He's author of the book Hobbies, Leisure, and the Culture of Work in America. Thanks for all of your calls about your hobbies. You can still email ideas@WPR.org if you have a hobby story to share with us. Coming up after the news, what's your favorite thing to cook and then freeze to save for later? We're talking about great freezer meals on this week's edition of Food Friday. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.